Something that I never would have expected, and maybe it's just what is normal. Maybe it's just what's normal for everybody. Maybe it's normal for you and won't seem strange or surprising, but for me, it certainly is. The thing that most radically punctures my filter bubble on the internet is contact with religious people. Mm. I very infrequently encounter like people who are far on the other political extreme from me. I very rarely encounter people from radically different socioeconomic worlds on the internet. The most different people are from me that I encounter on a regular basis online is religiously. I don't know if that was a grammatical sentence, but like I encounter a lot of people online who have very, very different religious beliefs from me or belong to very different religious groups from me. I encounter mostly Christian people. And that's like that's America, right? But like, I mean, overtly Christian people, like people who say like, I am a Christian person and identify that way. And it's not the way it is in my default life, in my offline life, in my professional life, mm-hmm. where it's like people who were raised Christian and who have no religion or people or who are like anti-religious, you know, I experience a lot more of that offline. But online, I meet so many people who are like religious people and who they're people that I love, that I'm really interested to follow, especially like almost like the more religious they are online, the more interested I am because I'm encountering something that I don't encounter anywhere else. And I don't know. I just found that surprising when it first started happening. I continue to find it surprising because I guess I've been indoctrinated growing up with like this message that we're entering this secular, humanist, futuristic, scientific age where people won't be religious like that anymore. But like there's all these high-tech religious people out there and I keep meeting them.
Well, it's funny because I mean, I actually feel like I kind of have a similar experience because you know, I would say that I identify as Christian, but the type of Christianity that is often talked about, especially in the United States, is not the kind of religious experience that I would identify with or have a lot of experience with in the last few years of my life specifically. Uh-huh. And I do remember having a cognizant thought as I became more and more of a person that like had a social life online, which is even a weird thing to think about. I don't feel like people think about the dualism or the dichotomy between real life, quote unquote, social life and online social life. But, you know, we're at the point where we all have that. If we're on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook even, and we're talking to people that we've either never met or haven't seen in person in a long time, I feel like you've created two different social worlds for yourself. And a few years ago, I was working at a church and I was recognizing that the people that I talked to in that experience, in my real life experience working at a church, and the people that I was talking to in this online experience were very different. Mm-hmm. And certainly people weren't walking through the doors of the church with completely different concepts of what spirituality was like, what religion was like, but they totally were on my Twitter. You know, I wasn't clicking follow or people weren't mentioning me, you know, if we had checked to make sure that we had similar spiritual beliefs before we started talking. Uh-huh. And this is nothing new. That's not like online social circles created this. Obviously, if you did anything outside of meeting people in a church, say playing a sport or going to the gym or going to a, you know, a card game, like you would meet people that didn't have that same perspective as you. But I feel like it's heightened online because of the amount of time we spend in it.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
And the fact that we can be in both places at the same time. Like I could be in the church with those people and pull Twitter out, and now I have friend group two, right? That's completely in a different place and maybe saying completely different things. And I definitely think that I think I've noticed how that kind of thing happens online. I think honestly, in a weird way, we both share a similar thing, which is because I don't identify as what maybe we could call like mainstream Christianity, or certainly like let's go even further and add some politics to the mix and say conservative Christianity. I identify so little with that, but I see so much of it in the news and online that I probably feel a little similar to you in the, wow, there's a lot of people that don't think the way I do. And here they all are sharing their thoughts, which can be either good or bad, depending on the kind of thoughts they have, I guess.
Do you seek it out at all? Like, because I've sort of gone back and forth in terms of my sort of browsing around for things to subscribe to and people to follow online between seeking out camaraderie with people who are like me and seeking out diversity of ideas and people who are really different from me. And I think I'm actually a lot more successful at the latter. It's a lot easier to find for me, and maybe this is what you're saying, it's a lot easier for me to find diversity and difference online than it is to find people like me.
Yeah.
But I've come to find that to be a sort of healthy or important pursuit, and I've sought it out a lot more. Do you do that too?
When I was thinking of that time when I was cognizant for the first time of, oh, hey, this online group of people that I follow. I mean, look, even just using like my Twitter stream as an example, right? Mm-hmm. Like looking at my Twitter a few years ago and having this really clear thought of, oh, none of these people that I'm following, I'm not following anybody because of their spirituality. Mm. I'm following them because of their personality, which was fine. But I thought maybe I should follow some people because of their spirituality. Mm-hmm. So I looked up book authors and speakers, and I've added a bunch of those people to the mix. And I can confidently say that in the time that has passed since then and now, I've unfollowed all of them because I've had a very hard time finding people that live online the same way that I do. I'll give an example of one that has stuck around, which is there's a person named, I think his name is Peter Chataway, and he's a film reviewer. And basically he reviews any Christian movies that come out that are like interesting to him. I think he works for like, how do you say that website? Patheos? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like a multi-religious website, I think. So, you know, there's like Christian perspectives and Jewish perspectives and Muslim perspectives.
Okay. Going to check it out now.
I think that's what it is. I could be wrong, but I think that's what it is. But in any case, I found this guy because he reviewed like some very standard Christian movie and also Noah by Darren Aronofsky, one of my favorite films, and loved it, you know, gave it a great, great review. And so I was like, here's somebody that understands the kind of stuff that I care about when it comes to spiritual films, you know, because so many Christians wrote Noah off because it didn't fit into a standard Christian narrative of that biblical story. So, you know, it's few and far between that I found people that I actually really appreciate following on online, but at the same time, I don't think that my goal today is to do that. I'm pretty happy to have a diversity of voices, which I think I certainly do.
Mm-hmm. I think that what I've ended up sticking with is people who have not, it's not exactly similar or different beliefs, but analogous beliefs is maybe the best way of putting it.
Yeah.
Like people from different faiths or no particular faith, but who still express their spirituality in a way that sounds familiar to me in new language. And that kind of learning has proven kind of unendingly helpful and fruitful for me to like hear Christians or Muslims who kind of land on the same, I don't want to oversimplify it, but like the same end of the spectrum as I am. And not that I'm on the end of the spectrum, you know, same point along the spectrum as I am. I mean, a culture critic like that, like somebody who could point me to books or movies or music would be sort of the ideal case, because there's, you know, it's one thing to just read blog posts and get small packages of words about it, but it's another to sort of have a new perspective on art and really get to dive in with your whole being to this different perspective. And that really does kind of describe how I think I've landed, which is it's this beautifully diverse coalition of voices on one hand, but it's people who speak. I mean, it's not that they speak the same language. It's that they can translate. It's that they have the ability to translate each other's thoughts into their own and translate their own into for each other. That sort of represents kind of the ultimate promise of online community to me. And its opposite is basically what characterizes the whole dark side of social media that we often find ourselves talking about, because there's no translation happening there. Everybody's just talking past each other and trying to signal to their own isolated tribes. This is like not that hard of a thing for me to do, like to find these voices. And though it does feel like I'm swimming upstream a little bit as far as what the tools and services and networks are trying to get me to do. And what they're trying to show me. I do have to go out of my way to find them. But of course, that's a pursuit that I love. That's like what we've done online since before there were algorithmically filtered feeds of information, is just kind of following hyperlinks until you find something.
Right.
Like RSS is definitely like one of the primary discovery tools for me for this kind of thing. How do you find people like that critic, and like where and what are you looking for? I mean, like, I know you're super into searching on Twitter. Like, is that where you're pulling things out of?
It's not. And like, I've never really thought of it until we've had this conversation, but like, I still haven't solved this in terms of figuring out how to get information. And yeah, like I think I've talked about this here, but like, you know, 20 times a day, probably, I use Twitter as a search engine for whatever I want. I'm following a very specific amount of people on Twitter so that when I have a question, I can type in a keyword and look at people I follow and figure out the thing that I want way, way more conveniently and way, way more clearly than if I would have tried to type it into Google. But I've never thought of doing that for like anything spiritual. Hmm. And honestly, as we've had this conversation, I think I'm realizing it's because I was made to feel like technology and spirituality weren't allowed together.
Ooh.
When I was younger. And I think that there's somewhere lingering in my brain that still kind of feels that.
Yeah.
Or believes that everyone else around me feels that way. Mm. And the memory that immediately comes to mind is when I was younger, when I was in middle school and high school, I was attending a church that was a great church, but it was very traditional in a lot of ways. And I, you know, we've talked about this, especially even in like our first episode, I was a person that was on that bleeding edge of trying to have what was existing before the iPhone in my hands before the iPhone.
Yep.
So I was the guy that had a Sidekick or a weird, whatever, Windows Mobile 7, whatever they called it, phone, before anybody did. So, you know, everyone was carrying around books, and I was carrying around these weird phones and using the internet or reading ebooks or doing whatever. And it was in a time where if you were looking at your phone, I guess you were straight up distracting yourself, which is still true with phones, but like, it's not always true, right? You know?
Yeah.
And I have memories of like being in like a prayer service or being in a church service and like looking at my phone for very specific reasons, you know, like reading the Bible even. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that anyone believed me, right? Like, I don't think that anyone believed that a 16-year-old kid in 20 whatever, when iPhones didn't exist, was actually doing something other than like texting his friends from high school.
Uh-huh. Or playing Snake.
Or playing Snake, yes. I did play Snake, I have to admit. But, you know, not in those times. Well, actually, probably sometimes in those times, right? But not always.
Yes.
And now, you know, I go to a church service at a massive church, and people say, turn to verse whatever, and 97% of the entire crowd is looking at it on an iPhone or an Android or whatever phone they have in their hands. Like, that's become completely normal. Huh. But for some reason, I still feel like I'm not supposed to have it. And I think I've been weirdly conditioned to feel that way. And honestly, I think that if I went around and polled people in the same like religious circle as me, I think that a lot of people might feel the same way. So I don't know. Like, I think that maybe some of this comes from the fact that Christians, or at least the Christians that I know, didn't take to technology in the way that I wanted them to. And I've always felt a bit put off by it as someone who embraced it so wholeheartedly.
That's really interesting. Jews in non-cloistered environments, like Jews in liberal country, like, let's just talk about American Jews, because, you know, I spent a year in Israel and things were really different there. Not that there wasn't any technology involved in, like, the, like, Orthodox worlds that I floated around, but certainly on holidays or on Shabbat, you know, it's out of the question. It isn't even really a tension. It's like everybody's on their phones all week, and then on holy days, like, there are no electronic devices anywhere, so it's explicitly prescribed. Here in the U.S. it's a little different, especially in the communities that we actually belong, Ariel and I actually belong to, which are sort of center left conservative Judaism, where many of the congregants will happily use their phones on Shabbat. But of course, everybody's supposed to know that you're not quote unquote supposed to use them. Rabbis could never be caught dead using their phones on Shabbat, even in those communities. And then, and now what's happening is there's a sign outside of every sanctuary in conservative shuls, like here in LA, on Shabbat that says, that always has some sort of kind of clever line that's like, today on Shabbat, we disconnect from the internet to connect with each other. Please turn off your phone before entering this space. Mm. And so, you know, it's been made explicitly into a practice. There's a well-established time-bound custom of turning off things like that in Jewish practice. But during the week, there are certainly, and I've certainly been in prayer spaces where people are using phones. I have really great iPhone apps with the whole daily prayer service on them, but only more observant people pray during the week. So, you know, it's really interesting how all the software caters to mostly Orthodox people. The whole corpus of scripture, including rabbinic later commentaries and mysticism and medieval stuff, is all available on one amazing website called safaria.org. I've never seen anything like it. It's just like such an enormous database of ancient, medieval, and modern wisdom. And you can put together your own source sheets and commentaries there that are then saved to your profile. And so there's this sort of layer of scholarship and sharing and social internet stuff on top of it, which is really cool.
It's really cool.
They do have native apps, and the native apps are really good. They even have offline archiving of the library, so you don't have to be online to look at them. But of course, on Shabbat, that all sort of feels weird. But I think you might be talking about something a little more than cultural, just like some idea that tech is of this world and not of the world to come,
right,
or something.
Right. I think that there's something kind of interesting what you just said to me, which is that in your circle, in your religious world, if you are particularly religious, you might be going to certain things that other people wouldn't be going to. And a phone might serve you well in those environments and no one would bat an eye. Where I guess in my Christian circles, there isn't really anything to differentiate you. And there isn't really any need, quote unquote, to use technology instead of using, say, a physical Bible. Beside the fact that having a e-book Bible is much more convenient and maybe much more beautiful. There's some really incredible apps out there that make it look awesome. Mm. And, you know, you always have it on you. So that's pretty nice. And of course, you can also do other things like have, you know, prayer books and, you know, whatever. Like, it doesn't matter. But I think that, yeah, there hasn't been this perspective in my religious world that said technology can be used for good. Oh, look, this is even influencing and helping people's spiritual lives. It's been the opposite, where it's been seen more as a distraction.
Hmm.
And I think that it honestly feels very similar to like a school, right?
Uh-huh.
Like if you're in a high school, I don't know what it's like to be in a high school where everyone has phones.
I bet it's chaos.
Yes, exactly. But, but I can't imagine that anyone is making a great case as a high school student of saying, no, look, I have ebooks of all of my books. You know, I don't have to carry around this heavy backpack. I can search them immediately, and like being taken very seriously. Even though that would be 100% possible, that would be totally possible. But I don't know if people would really consider that a good use of the phone, or they would think all these teens are just slacking off, you know?
Mm.
And I guess for me, a question that I have is just, I always hear these kinds of arguments, or at least play these arguments out in my mind, because I have to be honest, like no one's come up to me in a church service and like told me to turn my phone off.
Uh-huh.
But I have heard from speakers that they find it distracting when people are looking at their phones, you know? I have been in prayer services where people have asked me like what I'm doing on it. Mm-hmm. And they haven't told me to turn it off, but they did seem weary of the fact that I had it, you know, right?
Yeah.
But my question when I always think about these kind of things is like, what the heck is going to happen when technology just becomes more prevalent in our lives?
Yeah.
What's going to happen when we all have the glasses that make life way more convenient? Are you going to have to take those off when you enter that, you know, religious service on the day of rest? Am I not going to be able to have it in a church service? Mm. That feels incorrect.
Yeah, it does.
Once it becomes so good, I don't feel like we're going to be able to disconnect from it. And I'm not sure if that's a bad thing or if that's just a thing that religious groups need to get used to.
I think that there's something kind of problematic in the association of the lack of spirituality with the hardware itself.
Right.
You know, like that's not what it is. It's the experience I'm having to use so many words I don't actually want to use, but like, it's the content that matters.
Right.
This is actually the pitch that Safaria uses to raise money. I don't want to overstate it, but I think it's fair to say that Judaism has kind of a book fetish. Physical books really, really matter a lot.
Interesting.
As objects of reverence. I mean, I'm straining very hard to not say objects of worship, but a lot of really liberal people do kind of point to the way that Jewish services handle the Torah scroll, for example, and say, isn't it kind of idolatrous to put a crown on a book and carry it around the room? And that's not what I'm saying. I don't even want to use the word idolatrous because I think it's beautiful, because I think that because I have a refined enough understanding of what the religion is actually saying about the book and the text, that to understand that they're really seen more as vehicles, as explicit symbols. Like, we're supposed to understand it as a symbol. It's not that the Torah is magic. It's that the words are magic.
If we were to make a like dystopian novel about how the world crashes down after technology, you know, destroys us all or consumes us all or whatever, I could see a world where like there's a religious service where a old laptop boots up and there's like a
powered
crown.
Off iPhone.
Yeah. And like, it's like a crown logo. And then that website pops up or something like that, you know? So like,
exactly.
It's interesting to think of the difference between the paper and the digital screen. But I think what you're pointing out is that we have no problem with the paper version. We have no problem with the physical version.
Hi, Internet friends. It's John here. Internet Friends is brought to you by my work at Ablaze Interactions, where I solve communication problems for clients who work to repair our world. I can help with information architecture to transform your website, content strategy to tell the right story and reach the right audience, and writing and editing to find the authentic voice of your company or organization, your product, or your idea. Ablaze Interactions has consulted for world-renowned events, political candidates, law firms, nonprofits, and great apps on the App Store. Light up your ideas. Go to ablaze.co and let me know if you're interested in working together. The world of books, of religious books in Judaism, is amazing, fascinating. For a religion that's such a small percentage of the world, like, you would be amazed at sort of the publishing might of this people and the amount of effort that gets put into individual copies. You know, you go to buy some book written in the 1800s and it's leather bound and has like silver embossed crowns on the front. They're gorgeous objects. I have a bunch of Bibles and prayer books of my own, and Ariel has even more as a rabbinical student, you know, of the Talmud and the Mishnah, like all of these rabbinic books that you have to learn in order to be a rabbi. And there's like tens of thousands of pages of it. And so this is what Safaria says. They say, look, we understand that the cultural practice of reading Gemara from a book in the presence of other people is part of our religion. And the, you know, even the way that the text is arranged on the page is sort of an early pre-digital form of hypertext. And, you know, we want to preserve that forever, but we don't want to preserve it in 500 pounds of books that everybody has to have in order to learn this material. And what I look forward to is seeing what they're able to do with their, you know, their text engine, to see if they could actually faithfully recreate some of these amazing not only typefaces, but layouts of text and arranged like physical two-dimensional arrangements of text on the screen. Because I think it's a pretty obvious future where there are tablets in the back of seats instead of huge hefty books, you know, like, and there are tablets that you can adjust the text size on instead of doing what most, you know, synagogue books do, which is optimizing for the lowest common denominator of eyesight and making the text humongous, you know, like if everybody had AirPods that they could, you know, sync up to have the text be read aloud, accessibility issues would be solved.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's so many reasons to go this way. This is a little bit of a tangent. I think you were making a really crucial point, which is it's what you're doing that matters. It's not how you're doing it in a specific technical workflow sense. Whether you're thumbing through a 1,000-page book or pulling up a bookmark in digital form and going straight to it, the thing I have to imagine and hope for that future is that as we get into a world where digital and physical reality are more seamlessly integrated, it will be a simple matter of manners whether you're paying attention or not. And that's what it seems to come down to here.
Yeah.
It seems to come down to attention. When people are asking you what you're doing on your phone and services, I have to imagine at least part of them is wondering whether you're doing what everyone else is doing or not.
Yes, exactly.
Whether you're paying attention.
Yeah.
You know, obviously attention is a minefield when it comes to digital technology. It's like really where all of the problems stem from. I mean, this is also starting to open up the other religious tradition that I care a lot about by making attention the central problem, which is this sort of Buddhist contemplative tradition. Attention is the faculty of human consciousness that the internet is hacking actively. You know, it's the thing that Facebook is and Instagram and all these products are exploiting. It's the only currency. I mean, remember the phrase attention economy? Like, I think we may have moved past that just because
right.
The problems have gotten more acute, but like that was how this era was classified. And the risk to community, to mindfulness of the species that's posed by digital technology is the fragmentation of attention, and maybe even the segregation of attention into worlds that do not meet anymore. Like, maybe that's still principally a problem of attention, that like the tribal nature of the internet has just carved up the things that people pay attention to into worlds that never intersect anymore except to do battle. And the space of spiritual religious community, whatever that's about in an anthropological sense, fundamentally has to do with attention too, with everybody paying attention, having something in particular that they want to pay attention to, that they want to set aside time to think about their souls or whatever language they might use. And I mean, as funny as it is that last episode we were talking about a product called SoulSeek.
True.
I think that there's something kind of understandable about it seeming weird to look for your soul inside of a machine. Maybe that even raises kind of classical problems of consciousness or transmigration of souls or whatever. Maybe it's just troubling at this point because of metaphysical reasons. And when it is more normal, when the digital world is more normal, like maybe it's not that we're going to adapt our ways of using technology to better suit the ways we practice religion. Maybe the ways that we practice religion are going to change in ways that might be hard for us to imagine from this side of the sort of technological leap that we're describing. Maybe our religions will change.
Yeah, I think they have to, right? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, attention is a great thing to focus in on. I can tell you very clearly from my perspective that the church service as it stands right now, which you could pretty much walk into any Christian church in America and it would have a very standard template, which would be worship songs and then announcements and offering and then sermon and then everyone goes home. Like it's pretty mm-hmm. clear cut, no matter if the church is thousands of people or dozens or, you know, whatever denomination that it might be, it will be something along those lines. And I can tell you pretty clearly, especially in churches that have a lot of young people in it, that the attention being paid to those moments is greatly reduced because of the phones. Mm. And it's often true that churches will have like a college-aged service and like a high school service. And I know in my time in like college age services, basically everyone in the audience is sitting on their phone while someone talks up there. And they're certainly not all fastidiously taking notes. They're browsing Instagram. They're talking to friends. They're doing different things. And there's nothing that the church can do about that. Besides, I guess what yours has, which is, hey, turn that freaking thing off before you come in there.
It doesn't work. It doesn't. People don't do it. They're not sitting in the room on their phone, just to be clear. They're like, that's not happening, because that would be shamed.
Yeah.
But what's happening is their phone goes off super loud in the middle of like some solemn part of the service, and then they get shamed.
And I think that we're in this weird place where the phone is both like incredibly useful and terribly distracting. And both those things are true. Both those things have to be dealt with. But I feel like we're only dealing with the distracting side, and we're not dealing with it very well. And to go back to our earlier point, you know, like what you said about tablets being in every pew instead of like a book or whatever. I mean, that's already happened in Christian circles because of the lack of need for book beyond the Bible. Like, you know, I grew up with churches that you would have a hymnal in one little cranny and then a Bible in another. And those are all gone. Like everyone, or when everybody was reading, either they would like project the verse on a screen, or they would ask people if anyone needed a Bible. I haven't heard that in years. It's assumed that everyone's going to be able to read those verses, and they're going to pull out their phone to do it. Like, that's just the norm. And in the church that I go to, which is a multi-thousand person church that I attend on occasion here in the city, the guy who runs it, he's a big Apple fanboy. He comes out and preaches with his sermon notes on his iPad and an Apple Watch on his wrist. I mean, you know, he's not angry at Apple or technology. You know, he's using it wholeheartedly. And the service that he's cultivated has some really interesting technology adjacent things. I have some friends that are from Spanish speaking countries, and a few of them visited me and we went to church together. And one of my friends doesn't speak English very well and was told by some people at the front desk that she could download an app on her phone and, you know, put a headphone in, and they gave her a pair of headphones, and there would be a live translator that was translating the service into Spanish and getting it directly to her via this app.
Wow.
So there's tons of useful purposes that these iPhones are having in the service. And I also find it interesting, obviously this church that I go to isn't like angry at technology, but there are some that I've been to that are, and you know, there are big screens on both the left and the right side of the church service, you know, like projecting a bigger version of the person on the stage or putting words up there. And there are often cameras and then rooms at the back that either have sound people or camera people or, you know, whatever. And like those people are using technology.
Yeah.
So the entire service is being run by technology, and there are often big technological screens on every side of the stage. Yet still there's this distrust for this medium that's basically running the entire show at this point.
I think you might have just proven that it's going to be okay, though, because think about it. Like, TV isn't technology. TV is normal. TV is everywhere. Of course, we're going to have big TV in our sanctuary because TV is how we learn about reality.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
That's how the almost 100-year-old technology is being treated. You know, I'm sure we'll get there with small personal screens the same way. You have to hope. I mean, the book was incorporated at some point, you know, it's not like everybody had a printed prayer book before.
Here's my question. Okay. And like, this is a serious question that I'm not pitching as like a positive or a negative thing, just a thing, right? When there was no book, everyone had to deal with the fact that there was no book, and then everyone had book.
Yep.
And that didn't really change the service. I mean, it did, but it didn't. It wasn't like, no, I'm not going to go to this service.
It actually changed it dramatically, like just speaking from Jewish history, like having printed liturgy really did dramatically change what happened in synagogue. But the thing was, it was a change that was done with the full authority of the rabbis.
Mm.
And what's different this time is that there is no authority that understands the internet well enough to like change the liturgy to accommodate it yet. But like when my wife's generation are the senior rabbis, like maybe it'll just be dead obvious by that point.
Right.
It maybe happened the same way.
Yeah. And I can only speak from my experience in a Christian church. And I'm gonna be really honest here and tell you that I find church services boring. Like, I don't enjoy them as a religious person. I don't go every Sunday morning. I don't like them. There is so much power and so much beauty about a community all singing songs together. And I get a lot of impact out of that. Mm-hmm. But a 40-minute talk, I actually don't enjoy most of the time.
Yeah.
And I'm at a place that has some world-class speakers. And of course, I've heard some talks that I've really enjoyed, but not enough to make me want to go on a weekly basis and hear those talks.
Yep.
And I think that part of that reason is because we now live in a world where I can get access to information so easily. And I can get access to information that fits me so readily. There are books that I've read that I'm like, wow, this is exactly the kinds of questions that I have. This is exactly the kinds of thoughts that I have. I'm so glad this person is exploring it. And I can't get that when I walk over to a service that's in the same city as me. It's going to be very difficult to find the exact things that I want. But my question is, as these digital tools that we have get more and more normal, and as they take over more and more of our like physicality, mm-hmm. the example that I always use, and we've even used it on the show, is like as it moves from my hand to my eye, you know, the phone is no longer in my hand and I have to like turn it on and it's no longer even visible. I can be shamed out of using a phone in my hand, I guess, but I certainly won't be able to be shamed out of using a contact in my eye that no one can even recognize. It looks like I'm staring straight ahead, but I'm, you know, accessing the entire world's wealth of knowledge. How in the world is a church service going to compete with that?
Yeah.
And I really don't know the answer to that.
They already can't, obviously. I completely agree with what you said about services. And that's a pretty hard thing sometimes, given that my wife is about to be a professional leader of said services.
Right.
But of course, she also finds the status quo extremely boring. And what she wants to do in services is completely different from what we see in most cases. And she's increasingly getting, you know, the gig to do it her way. And she does the thing that comes naturally to her and seems like the obvious thing to do, which is play music and have conversations and do and pray outside and then come back in the room. Standing in the 1970s building praying is like not something that enters into it for her. And she does her thing. And then everybody comes up to her and says, that was the most amazing thing I've ever done in my life. And, you know, it is something that you can't download. On the other hand, these 40-minute talks that you're talking about, you know, I do almost all of my religious learning in podcast form by listening to talks of people who I do find interesting who don't live here, you know? I mean, so I listen to a few of the ones that are here, but I'm mostly listening to things from far away, and maybe from a long time ago. And I'd much rather do it that way. And I almost wish that the Jewish world would move beyond, well, I mean, I don't want to wish things for other religions, but like, I wish the world would move beyond the idea that what the way that you disseminate preaching is by putting an iPhone on the pulpit and just recording a thing that's happening in a room, and move towards a way of creating this material that's explicitly focused on this use case, which is, you know, the people around the world trying to fill their time with things that are spiritually fulfilling, rather than, you know, give up a fixed block of time to just sort of take in whatever is nearby. I don't think that's a good model. And I think that what should be happening nearby is the thing that you can't replace with the internet.
Right.
And there are all different things you can do. I think a lot of the anxiety in the religious world about the disruption that's clearly happening is about loss of community. And I think that that's exactly the wrong thing to be worried about. Like, what you should be worried about is why people aren't coming to find community in the mold that you've created for them. And it's because it's not an effective way of delivering the experience that they are looking for when they're looking for prayer and practice and learning. I don't know. I don't have enough data on hand to point to this as a trend, but clearly apps like Headspace, you know, and other guided meditation apps, most of which are secular apps, you know, like the ACLJ might call them Buddhist, but that's not what they really are. They're for anyone. and they are meditation practices. It may not be stuff that is given to people like in the traditional mold of religious teaching and practice that they come from, but lots and lots and lots of people are using internet technologies for personal spiritual practice time. And they're getting a lot out of that that they ostensibly should be getting at church or shul or at the mosque or whatever. Theoretically, like, prayer is supposed to play that role for people, but I would much rather do my personal meditation practice than do the kind of prayer that is done in synagogues.
Yeah.
And what I want out of a time where I'm going to gather with other Jewish people is like deep conversation, you know, or creative expression with each other, musical, artistic, or social action kinds of experiences, you know, like that, like sitting in a room listening to an in-person boring podcast is not what I'm going for.
Hello, internet friends. It's Drew, and I want to tell you about Keyhouse. There's a quote from Kurt Vonnegut that I read tucked away in an essay he wrote about the seasons, where he said that he thought that the idea of four seasons was a lie. Instead, we should have six. Fall doesn't move to winter, and winter doesn't move to spring. Instead, he thought the season should be like so. Summer, fall, locking, winter, unlocking, and spring. I believe there's a beautiful poetry to the idea that creation itself requires a time of unlocking before anything of substance can bloom. And perhaps you're listening to this message right now, stuck between what you're doing and what you want to do for the rest of your life, realizing that you might be in that cruel season of unlocking too. Find your own space for unlocking. Go to Keyhouse, KEYHOU.SE, and let's find the key.
What you just casually threw some shade on and walked right by was the fact that an article came out recently about schools that are using mindfulness meditation, either like, I guess it's apps. I think it's apps, right?
I think they are pre-recorded things of some kind.
Yeah, pre-recorded mindfulness meditations, and a conservative Christian group is very angry about these Buddhist meditations instead of Christian prayers that are happening in schools. And I think that's honestly a very good example of the kind of distaste or distrust of technology and distrust of technology playing a role in spirituality that I'm pretty used to seeing. This one is obviously a little more racist, I guess. I don't know, culturist, because yeah. It's specifically saying this other thing is coming in, even though it's not anywhere near that other thing. But regardless of that, I think that this is something that I'm seeing, and this is something that you're speaking to, is there's just no way. There's just no way that these things aren't going to get used. My wife uses Calm, the Calm app, almost every day because it's really helped her in ways that a church service has not been helping her create mindfulness in her life. And that's not a diss to the church, right? It's the fact that she can pull out at a moment's notice her phone, tap a button, and then press play on hundreds of different custom-made meditations and guided meditations, and all of a sudden she has an answer that she is seeking. Mm-hmm. Like, that's incredible, and that can't be replicated by a physical church, and it shouldn't be, really.
I agree.
And I think that actually what you said earlier about, like, there isn't anyone that understands technology, that's a great, great point. And I think that I've been mad at the times that I've seen technology used in a church service, because I think, wow, you're doing this in such a terrible way. You've made an app for your church that doesn't make any sense and no one will download. Mm-hmm. You know, you do weird things.
Because you think the way to get into the millennials' pockets is that we have to have an app.
Yes.
And so you get some off-the-shelf message board thing that, yes, like, is totally janky and then no one wants to use it.
Exactly. And I'm really surprised at the lack of, like, forward-thinking leadership I've seen. And I hope that there are some examples of stuff that are really good, but I certainly haven't really come across them. But at the same time, I also think that what you said is true in regards to the fact that I don't know if that's what the church needs to be looking towards anyways, because I am mad when I sit in a church service for 2 hours about the fact that I don't talk to the people to the left or to the right of me.
Yeah.
Because there's no time for that in the church service. And I would love for a church to cultivate community more readily, because they say, oh, the knowledge bit?
The knowledge bit's taken care of. Everyone's listening to podcasts and reading blogs and doing everything they need to. And I'm writing, you know, all the church staff, we're writing books and we're making video series. Everybody's, you know, inundated with knowledge at this point. They don't need to hear a random 45-minute sermon.
Yeah.
But what they need is people.
What they need is to come together and discuss all the different stuff they're reading and learning.
Exactly. Exactly.
This is going to be really hard for religious organizations to do, I think. Not just particular organizations, but, you know, it seems to me that religion is going to have to give up the idea that it has the total monopoly on finding meaning in life. You know, I think that is the Pandora's box that has been opened by technology, because you can find meaning from any corner of the earth in the present, past, or future now, and from other religions, from other churches, from other individuals, from true stories, from fictional stories. It's blown open, and it doesn't seem to me like a loss to think of religion as primarily a community building institution, and that function of it seems, if not irreplaceable, certainly it's uniquely positioned for that. Clearly, like, all attempts to do community building via the internet have proven disastrous. And I feel like religious institutions should feel really confident in their position as community institutions right now, because they're the antidote to the anti-community that's taking place online. But people are finding their meaning where they're going to find it. And that diversity of voices online can only contribute to, like, an increase in meaning to me. As long as people don't have tribal mindsets about what's okay and not okay to consume, you know, like, that does still represent the original promise of the internet, that everybody's voice will be out there and you'll be able to find what's meaningful to you.
Yeah.
And I think that the individualization of spiritual practice, that also doesn't bother me as someone who has a sort of contemplative bent as a meditator, that people concentrating on their own spiritual well-being in a kind of seated, eyes closed, focused way, that doesn't bother me the way it might bother someone who thinks that, like, prayer out loud is, like, the way to do that stuff. I think that's going to be the hardest kind of thing to let go, is that religious services have to be where people find spiritual fulfillment, because I think that people being bored in services is a 1,000-year-old problem. And I'm happy that people are going to be finding spiritual fulfillment through software and media and whatever ways of bringing that into their lives they come up with. Religion still has a purpose in this model, and I think it's bringing people together to share what they've learned. I find the idea of community, where everybody is the same, where everybody has learned the same things and done the same rituals and been sort of homogenized and then brought together, I find that to be so much thinner a model of community than one where people are doing their own thing, finding their own meaning and purpose and practice in life, and then coming together to share that in person under the auspices of, like, an overarching religious reason to be together. That feels like so much more dense and rich and vibrant of a model of community. I guess we have to just end by saying, like, I hope our generation figures out how to implement that finally, when the generation of institutions prior to this technological revolution finally gives up the reins.